Iran holds a state funeral for its renowned nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was killed in a terror attack near Tehran on Friday. The remnants of munitions used in the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist show Israeli weapons were used in the attack. Britain says this week is significant for Brexit as its trade talks with the EU near the deadline while serious differences remain unresolved. Iran has held a funeral for renowned nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near the capital city, Tehran, on Friday. Senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatami said that assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister promised a crushing response to perpetrators of the attack.
Assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Hatami urged Iranian authorities to bring to justice those who carried out the attack. Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Afsar, east of the capital, Tehran. In the meantime, informed sources said that remnants of the site of the assassination show that Israeli weapons were used in the operation. Now, the report comes as Iran officials have already announced that traces of the Israeli regime's involvement were found in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh. Authorities have pledged to revenge the murder of the renowned nuclear scientist. More international reactions are pouring in to the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist. The Iraqi foreign minister has condemned the killing, offering condolences to the Iranian government and people. Fuad Hussein also slammed what are called actions that do not contribute to supporting stability. The head of the Russian Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee denounced a terror attack as a crime. Leonid Slotsky says that the move is aimed at provoking Iran. The European Union has blasted the killing as a criminal act. Turkey called it an act of terrorism and said its perpetrators must be held accountable. The UAE and Jordan also condemned the assassination, calling for restraint. Now, author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says that the refusal of a number of world leaders to condemn the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist is reprehensible.
Oh, that's reprehensible that every leader of every country should be outraged at this, because it's a bad portent for anyone that wants to have an independent foreign policy. It's you just have no option in the American worldview. I noticed that Germany did express concern, and I'm sure that the United Nations will denounce this as well. So I think that some of the West have taken a more reasonable position, but everyone is afraid of the United States. So it's very, very hard to stand up to the United States. And obviously, this is a provocation on Israel's part to try and provoke Iran and to muddy the waters so that Biden cannot return to the nuclear deal. So I just hope that that doesn't happen.
Now, in other news, several European human rights envoys have deplored Saudi Arabia over its continued detention of women's rights activists. European rights ambassadors have criticized the kingdom for referring the cases of two women activists to a special court for terrorism offenses. They also urged Riyadh to release the women, including Lojain al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. Hathloul and Badawi were among many jailed during a 2018 operation targeting prominent opponents of the kingdom's former law, barring women from driving. The crackdown happened on the order of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman just weeks before the ban was lifted. A number of detainees accused interrogators of subjecting them to torture. The Hasloul family had also accused authorities of threatening to rape and kill her. The Yemeni army has carried out an attack on a military base belonging to Saudi-led forces, killing and injuring more than a dozen troops there. My colleague has discussed the conflict in Yemen with our guests in our news review program.
Welcome. The Yemeni army launches a ballistic missile attack against Saudi targets in Yemen's central province of Ma'rib, killing 8 Saudi commanders and soldiers. The spokesman for the Yemeni armed forces said the missile targeted an operation room in a military base belonging to Saudi-led forces. General Yahya Sari said the mission was carried out on Saturday afternoon using a Badr ballistic missile. 7 more Saudi military personnel were also injured in the attack. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The aggression has led to the death of tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Millions more have been displaced. The conflict has caused a dire humanitarian situation, which the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Joining us for more on this edition of the News Review is Yves Engler. He's an author and commentator, and we also have Jason Anure, a political commentator. Gentlemen, welcome. Yves, if I can start with you. Many would be asking this question at this moment in time, considering the recent operation that Yemeni forces have targeted Saudi military base in Yemen's Ma'rib province. Many would be asking, what's Saudi Arabia doing in Yemen's Ma'rib province?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia is violating international law and basically trying to turn Yemen back to the Stone Ages and force much of the country on assistance for its food and basically dominate a country with the full backing of the U.S. and much of the so-called international community of NATO Western states.
And Jason, a retaliatory attack by Yemeni forces. We're going to hear, as we usually do, a lot of condemnation from Western countries, yet the relentless Saudi bombardment of hospitals and schools. They're killing, 40 school children on a school bus with a U.S.-made bomb. There's silence. Well, explain that one to us.
Essentially, what we have is an imperialist endeavor in which Yemen is being attacked by Saudi Arabia for the benefit of imperialist plunder. Some of those beneficiaries include the United States, Canada, and the UK. So naturally, the news media organizations of those countries which are in support of the imperialist war, although they often don't explicitly say they are, tend to lie by omission by removing certain information from their reporting. For example, they will show outrage or just reports of Saudi Arabia being hit by Yemen, yet in that same breath, they will completely ignore when Saudi Arabia strikes and kills Yemeni civilians. Well, because it casts them in a bad light, because killing civilians is a bad thing to do. And since Saudi Arabia has stood so firmly as a U.S. ally, one that has carried out many of its interests in the Middle East, they're incentivized not to expose the crimes that they have carried out. And as a result of this, you get a very biased media, one that is not so much biased, but wholly dishonest by removing certain facts that would tell the truth about the situation on the ground and the ongoing Saudi genocide against the Yemenis.
Right. Yves, Jason raises a point there. This war has been going on for 6 years. The Yemenis, we don't hear reports of Yemeni forces killing Saudi nationals. We do hear vice versa, Saudi forces killing Yemeni civilians, whereas Yemeni forces tend to target Saudi military positions. But I guess 6 years, when is it going to end? And can it end if Western weapons supplies, the chain supply continues to roll to Saudi Arabia?
I think it's going to end when the U.S. primarily, but the other countries that are providing the weaponry, my country included Canada, when they say enough's enough. And if you look at the condemnations of the Canadian government, you'll find that it's only when the absolute worst violence by Saudi Arabia, when they kill 150 people at a wedding, that you finally get a very sort of soft criticism by the Canadian government. Obviously, if anything happens in Saudi Arabia, the Canadian government's immediately there to criticize Yemen, the Houthis, or Iran, or others. But it's only when it's the absolute worst of the violence by Saudi Arabia, the vast majority of it goes in silence. And the Canadian government, I mean, in the midst of all this Saudi destruction in Yemen, in the midst of growing awareness globally, in last year, in 2019, they doubled their arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Almost $3 billion worth of Canadian weapons were delivered to Saudi Arabia. There's many videos of Canadian light armored vehicles that have been used by the Saudis in Yemen, rifles, other weaponry that just continue to be used in Yemen. And so I think that really this is going to end when the Saudi monarchy is finally told by Washington, Ottawa, and others, no more, and we're going to stop providing the fuel, the weaponry, for this terrible destruction of human life.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for that. We've run out of time, I am afraid. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Eve Engler, author and commentator. Jason Onore, a political commentator. And thank you for staying tuned to this edition of The News Review.
Welcome back. Let's go on with the rest of this broadcast. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab says that the UK and the European Union are heading into a very significant week for negotiations on a post-Brexit trade deal.
I do think that this is a very significant week, the last real major week subject to any further postponement of the goalposts in terms of the timing.
In the meantime, EU negotiator Michel Barnier has described the current talks as an ongoing process. Months of negotiations have failed to bridge differences on competition policy and the distribution of fishing rights. Without a deal, the $1 trillion trade between the two sides will be at risk. Britain's transitional EU exit agreement is set to expire on the 31st of December. London has time and again said it won't seek any extension. European countries are tightening restrictions to contain the coronavirus as daily cases and deaths remain high. Italy reported more than 20,000 new infections on Sunday. It registered some 540 new deaths. Italy has the second highest death toll in Europe after Britain. The government there has imposed a nighttime curfew and closed restaurants and cafes. Also on Sunday, Britain announced more than 12,000 new virus cases. It's planning to toughen lockdown measures that would put the country under the two highest restriction levels. In Russia, the number of people who have contracted the coronavirus rose by more than 26,000. Now, in the United States, a top health expert is warning that America should prepare for a surge upon surge in COVID-19 cases in the coming weeks. Anthony Fauci said in an interview that an uptick in infections is inevitable following the Thanksgiving holiday travels. The same concerns have been echoed by the U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. Warnings come as officials say that more than 1 million people traveled through U.S. airports last week, marking their busiest days since the pandemic began. The United States is the world's worst country by the virus, having logged more than 266,000 deaths and 13.3 million cases. President Trump's administration has been criticized for issuing conflicting messages about mask wearing, travel, and the danger posed by the virus. Correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, says that additional COVID-19 surges in the states are quite likely. It's because many Americans have not changed their lifestyles yet.
That's right. And of course, this is going to happen because we haven't made significant changes in our lifestyles for the past several months. So the manifestation of what our practices and our principles and our behaviors is going to show up later on. Well, a lot of people think that because of the change in administration, there will be a change in behavior and a change in culture. But with that, there are those who are worried just how much that will impact the economy. With many people who are losing their homes or losing their businesses, the long going, the sustained closure of businesses and the truncation of lifestyles will further impact how people will deal with the economy. And so even though a new administration may show indications of a lowered spread rate of the virus, it may adversely affect the economy as well, which I think a lot of people are worried about.
Meantime, the World Health Organization is saying that a COVID-19 pandemic is threatening to reverse important gains made in efforts to control malaria across the globe. In a recent World Medical Report, the UN Health Organization said that progress in eradicating the mosquito-borne disease has stalled. It says deaths from malaria due to disruptions during the COVID-19 pandemic to services designed to tackle malaria will far exceed those killed by the coronavirus, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. The report also warned that disruption in access to effective treatment to malaria could lead to considerable loss of life. Palestinians have held a protest rally in a village of the West Bank against Israel's decision to raise it to the ground. That was part of an event to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Mona Kandil has a report from the West Bank.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed to drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
That's all for this news bulletin from Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Are really cute and interesting animals. They are one of the most intelligent types of animals on Earth. Elephants are emotional animals. Feelings like sympathy and altruism are visibly seen among them. However, these cute, clever animals have big ivories, which have made them exposed to the danger of extinction. The biggest enemies of elephants are humans, and this animosity is due to the fact that humans are after the elephant's ivory. It's a shame, of course. Well, today I'm going to visit a place in northern Iran. To the Ivory Museum of Ramsar. About 90 years ago, a building under the area of 578 square meters was built in the city of Ramsar in Mazandaran province. This magnificent structure has placed a unique museum inside. The Ivory Museum of Iran is the first specialized ivory museum in the West Asia region. This museum displays a very rare collection of artworks, including ivory carvings and fine art on ivory, which is very attractive. This museum includes 300 valuable artworks, which have been created by the artists of the East and Southeast Asia, as well as parts of Africa. Among the distinguished artworks showcased in this museum, mention can be made of different types of statues and decorative artifacts. I am now standing by the building of Ramsar Ivory Museum. This two-story building is white in color and looks really gorgeous. And the area around the building is a green space, which is so pleasant. Well, let's enter this really pretty building. Ivory Museum of Rome, Sar, consists of different sections, including the Chamber of Human Statues, the Chamber of Arms, the Chamber of Non-Human Statues, the Chamber of Elephants, and the Chamber of Decorative Objects. First of all, I'm going to visit the Chamber of Non-Human Statues. Stay with me. I am now in front of a very big window showcase, and regrettably, the first thing seen in this showcase is the huge foot of an elephant. Oh, I'd better skip this showcase. It makes me depressed. Okay, behind this showcase, there are small, delicate statues of different animals, all made of elephant ivory, including panther, crocodile, and even a tiny rat. Here's the Chamber of Human Statues. Wish you were here to see these delicate statues of men and women in here. Here there are statues of two East Asian men who are playing chess. Oh, the details of these statues are really unbelievable. Even the hair strands of these statues are delicately made. I am now in the Chamber of Arms. Here there are daggers fully made of ivory. And here there are swords with the ivory-made hilt. Oh, and how cute! Here there are plenty of sticks which have ivory decorations. I don't know since when the sticks became known as arms. I am now in the Chamber of Decorative Objects of the Ivory Museum. Just across from me, there is a beautiful ship with incredible details. Its beauty is indescribable. You have to come here to see all these beauties and delicacies. Oh, look at here. It's a wooden folding screen with frames which have lots of beautiful pictures on them made of ivory. What beautiful flowers! These flowers look so real that you feel like you want to pick them each. Well, it's as if all the art and beauty created by the innovative fingers of humans have been gathered here. However, we should not forget that all these beauties have been at the cost of the lives of thousands of elephants. Was it really worth it? I suppose not. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a top nuclear scientist, a husband, and a father. He was assassinated in a heinous terrorist attack in Iran on Friday. Condemnation of this terrorist act has been slow in coming from some Western countries. And why is that the case? Either they support terrorism or they don't. Either they are with the victims of terrorism or they are with the perpetrators. Is there a middle ground when it comes to terrorism?
2:30 p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept this car, carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered here outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of Detroit, Julia Kasem, journalist and writer. Out of the Netherlands, author, Uprising Today, Brett Jonkers. Thank you both for being with us. Let me start it off with Brett. Brett, we've seen yet another nuclear scientist in Iran assassinated in this terrorist attack. What do you think the main goal of this type of terrorism is?
Well, it's basically a continuation of something that has been happening for decades. In fact, even before the Iranian Islamic Revolution of 1979, it was already spoken about by Sayyid Ayatollah Khomeini back in the day, in which he said that the enemy of the Iranian people, the enemy of the Islamic Revolution, mostly, of course, the Zionist entity and the United States of America, have a keen interest in disrupting any form of technological progress being made by the Iranian people. And not just by the Iranian people, but basically by the wider global South in total. Because they have the idea, of course, that the global South, and especially nations that stand up against worldwide imperialism, that they should be completely dependent on the hegemonic powers for their technological progress, for their economy to function, for any sort of healthcare and also energy efficiency. The idea, of course, that Iran is pursuing nuclear energy in order to be self-sufficient in terms of energy and electricity is a major threat for the sanction regime that is in place against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, if you want to sanction Iran and if you want to destroy the country economically, the more self-sufficiency and autarky that Iran achieves by itself will undermine, the more this plan will be undermined. So there is a keen interest, both economically and ideologically, by the Zionists and the imperialists in the United States and in the West in general, to undermine whatever plan Iran has to make sure that they can produce their own nuclear energy and would no longer be dependent so much on fossil fuels, for example.
Julia, Iran has said that Israel has committed this crime. I want your perspective on that, and how likely is it that the United States has also been involved, in your perspective?
Yes, they definitely work in concert with one another, Marzia. Israel has waged considerable influence on the IAEA, the United Nations Atomic Energy Watchdog Unit. Since for the past 20 years at least, they have been pushing the narrative through the MEK terrorist organization that Iran's nuclear energy program, as Brett described, which is critical in transitioning Iran from fossil fuels and further developing its economy in a sovereign manner, is a, you know, absurdly illegal way that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons. The United States itself, in its own investigations, knows that Iran does not have an atomic nuclear weapons program. However, its narratives that the narrative that is pushed by the United States and Israel through the IAEA keeps on still assuming that, it's at least pursuing a nuclear weapons program through its development of nuclear energy. And that is the narrative that has basically gotten us to this point. In 2002, the MEK terrorist organization pushed that assertion, and then within a year, the United States responded by putting a additional sanctions and diplomatic aggression against Iran. And even considering that by standards of the Western-backed so-called international community, Iran has abided by all international agreements and has been a prime agent and leader in nuclear non-proliferation. It is a signatory and member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Israel is not a part of, and shows by even their standards, Iran is abiding by all standards of nuclear non-proliferation, which Israel doesn't,
okay,
because it wants to retain its hegemony in the region.
Stay with me, Julia. I want to pick up on what you said when I come back to you. But, Brett, when examining the situation in Western and Central Asia, many analysts and politicians say most of the instability can be traced back to the United States and Israel. Your take on this?
I think this is most definitely true. There is a lot of U.S. meddling going on, of course, in the Middle East in general, in the Arab world, in Central Asia. But the same, of course, goes for the Zionist entity. And we've seen more and more that the Zionist entity of Israel has been working, has been charting its own course, has been working sort of separately from the United States, and has because they know that they can always, no matter what they do, they can always drag the United States presidency and administration, the Pentagon, CIA, and as a consequence, very often also the U.S. public opinion into whatever conflict that they are creating. So this is something that you see here. You see the responses by a lot of even mainstream politicians in Europe and even in the United States who are seemingly quite shocked. Of course, they don't dare to go as far as to condemning it or calling it an act of terror. But this leads me to believe that this is most likely indeed some sort of a relatively solo operation, or at least, or maybe something that happened only in concert with the highest echelons of U.S. society, led amongst other people, of course, by Mike Pompeo, in order to strike once again against Iran before the Donald Trump administration runs out its course at the end of this year. So when you see these attacks taking place, not this year alone, Iran has suffered the martyrdom of two major figures of its country, of course, Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani being the first one, and Dr. Mohsen Farrokhzadeh being the second major one. This is an obvious showdown, let's say, that the powers that be, especially in Israel, they do not want a softer approach be taken towards Iran, a diplomatic approach towards Iran by, for example, the United States. I think the Israelis are getting scared that Joe Biden could continue the policies of the late Obama presidency regarding signing potential peace treaties or other agreements.
Well, Brett, let me just jump in here, because there are analysts saying that there's a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. But when we look at it, well, Julia, I'll throw this back to you now. When we look at actually American policy, one, in dealing with Israel and also in dealing with Iran, if we look at from the beginning of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 up until now, we see a certain consistency of American policy to continue to pressure Iran under the Obama administration. Actually, that's when several of the nuclear scientists had been assassinated. So is there really a difference between American administrations, Republican or Democrats, when it comes to their main policy on Iran, which is trying to put pressure on it, and many would say trying to overthrow the Islamic Republic?
Yeah, I agree. There is not a difference. Maybe a slightly in the short term, there is a difference in an approach with the Republicans pursuing and Netanyahu kind of in line with a more hardline strategy in the short term. But we have to remember, as you said, the four nuclear scientists that were assassinated between 2010 and 2012 were assassinated under Obama's term. The drone strikes across the region have expanded under Obama's term. And the JCPOA had put Iran under the assumption of guilt that it was pursuing nuclear weapons. So it was under the same basis and still would put punishing metrics on Iran should it develop its nuclear capacity for its own energy needs beyond that. And also a lot of the intelligence gathering that went to the IAEA, it's under suspicion that may have had a role in exposing Iran to exposing Iran's information on its nuclear energy to these Western powers that work under these agencies. So there's a more diplomatic short-term strategy, but it's another means of hegemony ultimately.
Brett, we're hearing from some Western countries calling on Iran now to show restraint, while at the same time not condemning this act of terrorism itself. But why would a government think that Iran, the victim of such terrorist attacks, should show restraint now? And why wouldn't a government such as the UK condemn this terrorist attack?
Yeah, and this is, in my opinion, this is a very clear example of double standards. It's the hypocrisy and the Western supremacist ideology that permeates all of Western society and politics, both left and right of the spectrum. And indeed, you know, in the United States, the Republican and Democrat alike, the idea that, you know, whenever you attack a country in the Middle East, for example, Iran, they are expected to show restraint. They are expected to come to the negotiation table. They are expected to keep on bargaining. They are expected to sign agreements that take away part of the national sovereignty, because, let's be honest, the JCPOA by itself was actually a violation of Iran's sovereignty, because they had to give access to their nuclear energy facilities. They had to declare not to do certain things. They had to, indeed, as was said, as Julia said very, very concisely, they had to basically admit guilt for something they had never done, which is trying to pursue a nuclear weapon. And but on the other side, of course, when you see an attack being committed against any sort of target in the West, for example, this is immediately considered a major violation of all humanitarian law, and this was considered a ground for war. I think one of the best examples is that in my own native country of Belgium, when you look at Iran being talked about in the media, the murder of Dr. Farizadeh is only a very small item on the list, because when in Belgium, when people talk here now about Iran, they're talking about this alleged plot that they have captured a bunch of Iranian Belgians who are suspected of having tried to commit an attack against an MEK meeting in Paris. And the MEK, which is one of the most prolific terrorist organizations in the 20th century, which has killed 17,000 Iranians in the past few decades alone, is now officially considered quote-unquote Iranian opposition in Armenia. So this alleged attack against terrorists who gather freely in France, in the streets of Paris, this possible attack that was maybe being planned is considered a bigger problem than the constant murders of Iranian people by Zionists and by American agents. So this is the typical double standards, this is the sickening double standards that has existed here for decades and is permeating all of our politics, all of our propaganda media. The idea, of course, that a nation that resists against imperialism, these people are considered to be basically subhuman. They might not say it in such way, not in with that many terms, but when you really look further than the way they try to describe it, when you look further than the propaganda language itself, that's what it comes down to. The lives of Iranians or Iraqis or Libyans or Syrians or anyone basically living in Africa are considered to be of vastly inferior value than the lives of Westerners or of Western allies.
Well, Julia, after more than 40 years of sanctions on Iran, do you think those entities which have tried to overthrow the Islamic Republic are showing signs of desperation that they are initiating or continuing these types of terrorist acts? And does it show that the policy of maximum pressure on Iran has failed?
It absolutely does. The policy of maximum pressure is a regional strategy, like you said, of desperation, of having the Gulf countries, which are always covert allies of Israel, kind of come out into the open to receive their defense and military packages from the U.S. In an obvious escalation against Iran, as well as the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, of the nuclear scientists, show that there is no other recourse that the West can take in countering Iran except by unjustified acts of terrorism against top officials and top apparatuses of government and security. It is completely, they act in complete impunity while doing this, which is perfect with your description of the West actually demonstrating terrorism in their approach to foreign policy. One wonders why they constantly have to have the monopoly on violence and of force in an unjustified way. Now, Iran, if we're going to talk about restraint, Iran has gone out of its way to show restraint by barely even responding to any of the deaths and assassinations that have took place, not just in this year, but in the last 10-plus years. And its response to the sanctions have just been to develop its own internal economic, capacity in a way that it's more towards sovereignty from the Western axis. And then they get punished for that, too.
Well, Julie, let me just jump in here, because you just talked about being punished for trying to develop various things inside the country. And I want to look at that with all the pressure, with over 40 years of sanctions and so many different types of war, where we're talking about the 8-year imposed war or media wars or cultural wars, of course, that we have seen. What was key in your perspective that Iran has been able to progress and advance so well technologically?
Yeah, so technologically, I mean, even being in Iran, just seeing how they have been developing their own internal, technology, applications, how they've still been able to, you know, develop their medical field and their energy capabilities by reducing their dependency on oil so successfully is a testament to their economic sovereignty, their goals of economic sovereignty be achieved even under these conditions of extreme sanctions. And to see this approach taken by Iran to actually use sanctions and use this delinking from the West in their favor towards economic sovereignty has just been incredible and a testament to its objectives in doing so.
All right, let me get Brett in on this because we're quickly running out of time. But Brett, what is key now in your perspective in dealing with this type of terrorism? There are some that say that these entities want war to begin with, or some say they're just trying to impede Iran's progress. But what is key in your perspective now in dealing with these type of illegal acts?
I think the key thing here is that you have to retaliate in a way that is of sufficient proportion, that has to be a response that will send a clear message that this Iran will not just roll over and accept these sort of attacks to happen, while at the same time, of course, always being wary of the potential lures, the traps that might be used to lure the country into an all-out war against any regional powers in the area or international imperialist powers. And I think this is very well summarized when the Rahbar said it, when Sayyid Khamenei said, we will not accept these dictates from the United States, nor will we go to war. You know, Iran has always been very good at finding this let's call it a middle road, in which they do strike back, they do attack, they do help regional powers, other friendly nations build up the axis of resistance, they do fight against the Zionist incursions, but they don't go openly to war, and they definitely do not initiate any conflict that can then later on be blamed on them. And I think this is the key strength, one of the key strengths of the Iranian Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Okay. Julia, 30 seconds, same question.
Yeah, exactly. So also Iran's development of a resistance economy too, in line with this philosophy, where the economic terrorism, in addition to the military terrorism, is harnessed as a strategic node of enabling Iran to develop a sense of economic sovereignty and also expanding it eastward to new allies, to neighbors. You know, it delivered oil tankers to Venezuela, developing relations with China, and across the resistance axis nations too, are a testament to its proactive approach.
Okay.
And,
And on that note, so sorry, we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me. Out of Detroit, a journalist and writer, Julia Kazem. Out of Hazat, Brett Yonkers, author of Uprising Today. And as always, we really appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi signing off for myself and other group right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.